What is going on, everybody? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. I'm your host, Curry Blanford, and today I'm talking to Megan Chance. So Megan has a book she released actually last week called Women Rising, Learning to Listen, Reclaiming Our Voice, which is just about women and the subjugation of women that's done by the church a lot of times and what we can do about it. And her book is a memoir of her life and these experiences she had overseas and seeing what women go through overseas and then bringing that into her own story and own experience and her journey of going through a woman very kind of comfortable, caught up in this system of subjugation to somebody sort of seeing the evils of that and fighting against it. And so I think you're going to get a lot out of this episode. I always love a good memoir episode where you see God's hand throughout someone's entire story, shaping them to do the work to which they are now doing, to which they are called to do. And so Megan is vulnerable in this episode as well, just the places where she had hard times of learning things and had to grow in really, really short periods of time. And yeah, you just see God's love over this entire story. We talk about relationships, we talk about life, and there's so much good stuff in this one. Just to note, if you have little ears listening, this probably isn't the best one to listen with them around. I know I always listen with my kids, just want to make sure. We do talk about just trauma and some hard things in this episode, so just a fair warning on that. And yeah, I really hope you enjoy hearing from Megan. Before we get to the episode, I just want to remind you to make sure you're following me on Instagram and Facebook at Theology of Hustle and on Twitter at Curry Blanford, just to stay up to date with the amazing people coming on this podcast and all the great stuff we have going on. So I really hope you enjoy hearing from Megan. All right. Well, Megan, thanks so much for making time for me and coming on the podcast. I'm excited to talk.
Absolutely. I'm happy to be here.
Let's just jump off maybe and just have you introduce yourself to everybody a little bit.
Yeah. So my name is Megan, Megan Chance. A lot of people don't know how to pronounce my last name.
I was going to ask that.
Yeah. but it's like Chauncey Billups, the basketball player without the E at the end. So that's the way I teach people how to say it. I am a podcaster, soon to be author. I have my first book coming out May 11th. And I'm a former missionary that worked with sexually exploited and oppressed women who realized my complicity in their oppression and have since been trying to do better and call the church to treat women better.
Yeah, I love that. I did have a chance to read the book. It's awesome. I highly recommend it. I was telling you earlier, just so many emotions came through. Like each chapter had its own sort of like wave of emotions. And yeah, very well done. Mm-hmm. Much appreciated. I loved that you just told your story though, in a lot of ways. Like you can't argue with somebody's story, right? Like you can't be mad about somebody's story because that's their experiences and that's what they went through. So can you just kind of maybe give us the primer into sort of what launched all of this stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up in the conservative evangelical church. Was raised as a woman to believe that my primary role on this planet was to serve my future husband, who didn't exist at the time, right? So this idea that I was there to stay in the home, to serve my husband, to be silent, to be submissive, and to be sexually available for my husband. These were kind of the teachings that I grew up with. And as such, when I went to college, I went to school for journalism and worked for a newspaper and discovered after working for a newspaper that I hated it. And I was like, okay, well, I'm just going to jump into serving God. And as a woman, my options were quite limited in the context I was in. I could either become a pastor's wife or I could become a missionary if I wanted to serve God. And so I chose to be a missionary. It was what was available to me. And of course, the draw of travel really interested me. I really wanted to help people. And it was through missions work that I encountered oppression of women from things ranging in from female genital mutilation. For those who are not familiar, that's a very violent process where a woman's or a girl's external labia or their whole external genitalia is removed to make sex painful. And it's an extremely dangerous process, and girls often bleed to death. And so I encountered that firsthand. in my missions work. And as I went on, I encountered sex trafficking, and I encountered widows who had been beaten to, you know, within an inch of their lives. And I just heard story after story after story after story of women's oppression. And it was towards the end of, my missionary career, for lack of a better term, that I was serving in the Philippines. And I was working with a ministry that it's called Wipe Every Tear, that gave women who had been sex trafficked an opportunity to go all the way through college. And so that was really necessary, because a lot of these women have so few options. And so, like, if we're talking about the climate change that's happening right now, a lot of provinces around the Philippines, so these little islands, are getting wiped out by hurricanes or typhoons, and it like destroys a family's way to eat and survive. And so they'll send their oldest children to the city and say, hey, find a way to feed us, find a way to get money. And so you hear these stories again and again of these young girls or women going to the city to try and provide for their family, whether that's their children or their siblings or their family, and having no options because they don't have a formal education, and getting trafficked into the sex trade. And so oftentimes they think they're going to be working in a restaurant or a bar, and it's a lot more than that. And they didn't know that. Sometimes they do know what it is, but have no other options to feed their families. Sometimes it's their families that are forcing them into this. I heard a variety of stories of how they ended up there. But the bottom line is, you know, the women don't have options. It's a danger. It's very dangerous for them. And it's super degrading. And so it was there that I was talking to a woman, and it was her first night in the bars. And she was showing me like these marks where her boyfriend had abused her, and she's just trying to provide for her child and had no other way. And as we were talking, these six drunk men came up to us and wanted to buy her for the night. And she said no, and technically she should be able to say no, but they didn't take no for an answer. And I said no, and we were all saying no, and they started grabbing her. And I remember being frozen, not knowing what to do, until a teammate ran over and said, why don't you just buy her before they can? And so I ended up buying her, and they still tried to take her, and we ended up getting in a fight with these bar managers, and eventually won the argument that she was our purchase, which is just a crazy concept. And she was able to go home. But unfortunately, these men that wanted to buy her, these drunk men, just become incredibly angry and just grabbed another girl off the stage. And I remember in that moment thinking that I had made the situation worse, because this woman was like walking away, and she looked back at us, and you could just see terror in her eyes. And I thought, oh no, like I have just, you know, made the situation worse. Angry men are so much worse. Men who feel like their pride or ego has been ruined or damaged are so much worse than men who haven't. And it really had me start asking the question, rescue efforts are good. Like, don't hear me say that it's wrong. It is good. But I saw in just a span of, you know, a couple of minutes, how quickly and easily women were replaced to meet this demand, this never-ending demand. And so I started asking questions. Why is the demand happening in the first place? Why am I seeing so much violence of women? Why does this keep happening? And it was the next night that I was in the bars that my question was answered in the most unusual way. An American man had called us over. So he was there purchasing women. He had this young girl under his arms, and he was asking us why we were there, and we told him, and we asked him in return, why are you here? And he went on this long tirade of how women here are raised to respect men properly, and women in the United States do not. And so he comes here to get the respect that he deserves. Mm-hmm. And it was like a light bulb went off in that moment, because it sounded so familiar to me, this idea that women must respect men and men are entitled to respect. And if they don't get respect, they'll find a way to get respect. It sounded a lot like the teachings I had grown up with in the conservative church. Yeah. I mean, if we look at books like Love and Respect by Emerson Eggerichs, that's the whole premise of the book. Men need respect. Women must give that respect to men. And I saw, like, in all of these like past experience I had, wow, this need for respect and power, it was like a light bulb. Like, this is driving the oppression of women. And so it was that, through that realization, that I realized if we're ever going to prevent violence against women, we need to first change the way men and women are seen. We need to make it so they're more equal. But yet the church that I had come from, was complicit in these extreme power differentials that demanded that a woman be submissive and silent and meet the needs of a man, while the man was supposed to be dominant and in control and aggressive. These were all these scripts that were playing. And so this inequity was absolutely driving the harm against women. And it was a terrible realization to realize that me and my people were complicit. And so I quit my job. 3 weeks, I was about to get married. I quit my job. Luckily, my husband supported me and empowered me. And I started a podcast called Faith and Feminism because I felt like, goodness, like the church needs to get on board with women's equality and women's rights. But for so long, women's voices have been silent. So yeah, that's how I ended up doing the work that I do. That's what this book is, you know, essentially about. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, no, this missions trip that you were on was not like a week-long sort of situation, right? No. I mean, was it almost a year, right?
It was years. So I did several trips around the world. Okay. So it was a year. And then after that, it was another 6 months. And then after that, I worked for the missions organization where I led trips quite regularly back. Okay. And so the whole time that I was a missionary, either working for the organization or on the missions field, was about 5 years.
Yeah.
So
that's cool. And I loved just the story of all that. And like, I feel like you didn't pull a lot of punches with the things you sort of experienced. Mm-hmm. And one of the first aspects of your story that really struck me was when you were in Tanzania and you were like seeing all these things, like these women were, you know, in tough situations. So you sent an email out to the, you know, the director, and you talk pretty openly about how all that went down. Do you mind sort of like walking through that exchange and what that meant to you?
Yeah. So I think that's another thing that we need to talk about in the church is this concept of missions and white saviorism and this idea that because we're white, that we can save other people. There's almost this elitism that we have in missions, that I have what you need, and I'm not going to listen to your actual needs because I can fix your problems with a prayer. And I think that is sadly what I grew up with. So to bring this into context, the story in which I tell this, there was a lot of women who were telling me that they had been physically beaten by men in their village. And after seeing months previous of women's oppression, I wanted to do something about it this time. I didn't just be like, oh, that's sad, and pray for them. I wanted to do more. I wasn't okay with this. And I reached out to my sending organization, the founder, and he told me to start an organization. And so I want to be clear that I was in this country for a total, the program I was on was called the World Race. And so we'd spend 3 to 4 weeks in each country, and there was 11 countries in 11 months. And so I was only going to be there for 3 weeks. By the time I emailed him, it was probably only 2 weeks. I probably only had 2 weeks left. And he told me to start an organization, which is silly because I was going to be there for 2 weeks. And what kind of organization could I start? Number one, not knowing the full details of the culture, what had led to this, the problems they were experiencing. And then also knowing that I wouldn't be staying longer than a few weeks. But regardless, he's like, okay, why don't you start an organization? I had been reading this book called Half the Sky, which is an incredible book. But it talked about how microfinance can sometimes level the playing field in terms of women, like the violence that women experience, because it gives women more power. This concept I talked about before, and how power differentials drive violence towards women. And so I thought, well, maybe microfinance, like maybe I can introduce a microfinance program here. And so he put me in touch with this head of a microfinance organization in Africa, and he immediately called out my white saviorism. He said, you are making a lot of blanket statements without knowing a lot about these women's culture. You said they were uneducated and because their education looks different than yours, but have you ever survived a drought? Do you know how to raise multiple children? Do you know how to live off the land? Of course, I didn't know any of these things, but I assumed because their education didn't look like mine, that they weren't educated and that this was part of the problem. And so he went, him and I had a series of emails that were exchanged, and they were painful for me. So painful for me at the time, because this is in 2012. No one was talking about white saviorism. I thought I was doing what was right, but he was directly and gently at the same time telling me what I had done wrong and how I needed to correct my thinking and how I wasn't the savior and I wasn't supposed to save them, but maybe this would be a good learning opportunity for me. And so that was my first introduction into this concept of white saviorism. And it took me, sadly, many years to fully grasp that and get the resources. I mean, I feel like just in the, you know, last 5 or so years, a lot more resources have come out. Like an incredible book is Me and White Supremacy by Layla F. Saad, that me and a group of friends have been going through while I was actually writing the book. So it was really helpful to even learn on my past experiences. Oh, I didn't even realize like how wrong this is. So anyways, all of that to say, There's an aspect of white saviorism that I had to unlearn, and I hope that the church unlearns that, because there is a lot of supremacy, and we also need to dig into the history of missions. As I've been digging into the history of missions, it hasn't always been beautiful. You look at, for example, the papal bulls that were issued in Europe. This whole concept that land could be conquered for Christian monarchs and they would kill or convert. Those are those two options. And this is history of missions. And then here in the United States, it went to the Supreme Court when we were taking over native land, and we won the court case because we were taking it over for Christian missions or whatever. So this whole idea of Christians' missions has been taking land from people. It's been violent. It's been terrible. And so we need to reconcile with that and be educated on that before we even consider doing missions. And we need to learn from the culture. And finally, I think we need to become, as you know, if we do have a heart to help people in other nations, I don't think that's a bad thing. But I think you need to learn and come from learn and support someone that's already there, that's already started. And that's one of the biggest lessons I've learned. People who are already seeing the issue, like, for example, if we talk about female genital mutilation, if I had gone to, you know, start an organization that fights female genital mutilation, I would not understand the culture. I would not understand the practices. I would not understand what it's like to be living and growing up in that culture. Yet there's so many women, the most powerful activists we have against female genital mutilation are women who have grown up in that culture and oftentimes endured and survived that practice themselves. And they're the most effective. So if I'm passionate about like ending female genital mutilation, my role should be a supporter to someone who's already doing the work. And so I think that's a problem that a lot of us have, is we see a problem, we think we know how to fix it without educating or even understanding the culture in which this problem arises. And so that was a huge lesson for me, and a painful one, if I'm quite honest, but an absolutely necessary lesson.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's good. I mean, I felt pained like reading those emails, like on your behalf. I was like, woo, I've been there, you know?
Yeah.
But it was cool that he was willing to sort of have that conversation, I guess. Right. And be confrontational.
Yeah.
But yeah, it changes a lot of sort of how you think about yourself and like what your purpose is. Cause I felt you wrestling with like even the purpose of your life, even right there. Like, am I doing anything like worthwhile? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, struggling with the kingdom of God. And as you, as you work through that process, I think you said, and I think I quoted this, that the culture you grew up in or the churches you grew up in, messy endings weren't allowed. Mm-hmm. Right? And so there was this need to like have it all sort of put together like at all times, right? Can you talk just a little bit about some of those feelings?
Yeah, absolutely. I just think that in the church, we have this tendency to spiritually bypass really messy things. We might be feeling maybe grief or sadness or depression or rage or anger. And so often I was told, don't feel those emotions, just focus on God, just like bypass those emotions and focus on God. But what that actually ended up doing was that I wasn't self-aware at all. I wasn't aware of the way I interacted with the world. I wasn't aware of my own emotions. I had stuffed everything down because I thought that was the holy thing to do. Unfortunately, what I found is that's not the holy thing to do. I think the more we dive into those emotions, those are cues, those are gifts from God. If I'm feeling anger, I should be curious about the anger. Why am I feeling anger here? Yeah. What is it telling me? Is it due to an injustice? Is it due because I'm being treated poorly? If I'm feeling grief, why am I feeling grief? Asking, interrogating those emotions. They're not bad emotions as we've labeled them. We don't need to bypass those emotions. We need to be curious, because those are signals that I think God has given us to dive into those areas to help us navigate the world. Those are clues of our conscience. There's a reason that we get upset at injustice. We're not supposed to bypass it and be like, oh, I give it to God. I trust God to take care of it. We need to dive into those emotions. And so for me, being raised in the conservative evangelical church, and like, I'm telling you, I was always afraid I wasn't good, because that was kind of the theology I was raised with, is that humans are terrible, and the only thing that makes us kind of okay is Jesus. And it was almost like God was this giant narcissist that only loved Jesus in himself and could only look at Jesus. And I think that's harmful on many aspects, but one of them is like, I thought I was bad, and it produced all of these really harmful behaviors as a result. And I think there's even this quote that we hear all the time in Christian spaces. It says, more of God, less of me. But I think that's a misunderstanding of what Paul was saying. I think it's supposed to be more of God, more of me. The closer we are to God, the more free we are to express ourselves. It says in the Bible that God knit us together in our mother's wombs. And so I think the closer we meet God, let him get into those painful parts of our lives. Let him dive into those questions and those doubts and those fears and the anger that we have. I think we became more full and more what God intended for humanity. But when we stuff down those emotions, when we stuff down our hurts or our pain or our grief, I think it's really easy for us to become not only not compassionate towards ourselves, but we can't have compassion towards anyone else. And so injustice doesn't matter to us because, emotions, feelings, those don't matter. What matters is heaven. But I think what's on earth really, really does matter. And so when I say that messy endings weren't allowed, is I wasn't really allowed to ask questions or have doubts or have grief, because when I brought those to the table, I was told just to focus on God and just to bypass those emotions. And I think what I should have done is said, hey, emotion, God, can you meet me in my anger? Can you meet me in my grief? Can you help me understand these emotions? And let them be tools to help me navigate this world and what I should be doing with my purpose. And so, I wish the church would stop spiritually bypassing and really dive into those cues that God gave us so we can understand ourselves and the world a lot better.
Yeah, I think that's good. Mm-hmm. That's important stuff. I've been on my own journey of like experiencing my own emotions, right?
Yeah.
But I wonder how much of just how you talked about sort of how men grow up even, right? And like the bypassing of emotions for men especially is very prevalent, right? Mm-hmm. And I wonder how much of that power dynamic is just men not even being able to be in touch with their own emotions or their true selves at all, you know?
I actually think that's another, I think I talk about this in the book. If I haven't, I hope I it's an important point. But this whole idea that men are kind of given a script, right? So we look at scripts, like women in so many ways are allowed to express so many more emotions than men. And unfortunately, that's been used against us. Like, she's too emotional to lead. Oh, I think humans are emotional and should be allowed to be emotional. Right. But specifically for men, there's like this idea that you can only express anger, like our dominant emotions. You have to show your power. And I mean, if we're looking at let's talk about mass shootings. This has been happening a lot in our nation. And they're, I think it's out of the last 118 mass shootings, I think 114 have been men. And so we need to ask, why is violence most often done by men? And this is also true of like domestic violence and other situations. Why is it men that are primarily hurting people? And I don't think this is because men are more violent. I think this is because men have been told that their emotions, their sadness, their grief isn't healthy, and that the only way they can express any emotion is through anger or maybe sexual prowess, you know? Yeah. So this is how they feel like, I might be feeling grief, or I might be feeling sadness, or I might be feeling like I'm being bullied. And so the way I'm doing that is I'm taking my power back. I'm showing my power. I'm showing my anger. Instead of being allowed to process grief and being allowed to cry and show those emotions in another way that it just like breaks my heart. Is so when I got married, my husband is like not sexual touch, but just like physical touchy. He's always touching me. He's playing with my hand, playing with my hair, like rubbing my back. And I'm like, wow, you're like so touchy. This is so interesting to me. And I was talking to this, she's a Christian sex therapist about this. And she told me, I had her as a guest on my podcast, and she told me that young, or brought to my attention that young boys are not even allowed to have physical touch from their parents or loved ones from the age of like 6 or 7 until they're married and have like an excuse to finally be able to get that need of physical touch left or met. And that just broke my heart, because while I was allowed with my girlfriends to be cuddly and touchy and huggy and all of that stuff, that was not allowed given the gender script that men have. And so, of course, there's like all of these, you know, maybe they don't know how to handle consent and all these other issues because they haven't been able to talk about it or process it. They haven't had their needs met with physical touch. And so this gender role theology that I talk about, it's not only harmful to women. I already talked about the violence that women have to survive, but it's also extremely damaging to men. The idea that you always have to be in tough and in charge and know what's happening and not allowed to ask questions or have doubts or have anything. And I think it's really sad, because I think it stunts men. It keeps them, you know, bottled up inside and not emotionally healthy and not being able to process that. And sadly, and this doesn't happen for all men, but for a lot of men, this does often look like violence. I mean, yeah. If we talk about, you know, for example, PTSD, men coming home from the war, we often know that these men might cause harm towards their family. We hear a lot of stories of like wives being beaten or children being beaten as a result of these men having PTSD. Well, and the gender script they're given, they have a trauma that needs to be addressed and met with gentleness and kindness. They need to be allowed to cry and express that emotion. But because of the script they've been given, they can only express these traumatic things through violence. And I think this is a huge, it's a huge sadness and grief to me that men aren't allowed to express God-given emotions. And I think that's a way that, you know, gender role theology also harms men. And so that's really sad to me.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think there's a straight line through like a lack of emotional intelligence and this sort of like patriarchal system that we've set up, especially in the church. You know, it's like, oh, I have to have power. I have to have power over women. Right. How am I going to manipulate the biblical text to make sure that my power is sustained? Right.
Yeah.
And a lot of it, I think, has to do with that emotional piece. There was a great story that you talked about where you were at sort of maybe a low point in your life, and you saw one of these men, I think it was, who was buying a woman. And, and like at that moment you understood that you'll definitely tell it better than me, but you understood God's love for you in like a new and profound way. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. And so like, again, I talked about earlier that like, if we can't have compassion for ourselves, we can't have compassion for others and vice versa. And so I had grown up in a context where my mistakes were not okay. I was not really allowed to be human. And I felt so much guilt and condemnation for screwing up. And I would constantly screw up. And the way I sinned, it didn't look like, you know, it was never like going out and drinking, like whatever people say it is. It was like, oh, I'm feeling like really like unloved right now. Can you love me more? Or can you like just like almost demanding and trying to manipulate situations so I could get words of affirmation or some way to know that I was loved? But what I found is like, no matter how much love that was shown towards me, I couldn't receive it because I had this underlying idea that I was bad and I was really like irreparably broken. And I think a lot of us who've grown up in the church have these feelings like, I'm uniquely irreparably broken and no one can fix me. I mean, I do all these good works, but I still feel broken on the inside. And we're kind of like not allowed to talk about that. And so I was on the mission field feeling this way. You know, my teammates were frustrated with me. I was frustrated with my teammates, but I kind of felt like I was uniquely the problem. And I remember going up, they had this like rooftop bar where I was staying, not a bar, it was like a rooftop where you could see. And I was listening to worship music, and it was right next to the red light district. And I saw a man who had just purchased a young girl. And usually I just felt nothing but anger and hatred towards these men. Like, how could you like exploit a woman in this way? And I had seen so much violence. I had no compassion. And so I felt like during this like worship session I was having that God wanted me to watch this man. And so I watched him and I saw that when the young girl that he had purchased had gone up to go buy some drink and he was left alone. And as I saw him when she wasn't with him, he was insecure. Like I could just read insecurity like radiating off of him. He was unsure of himself. He didn't like, you could see that he was there. And not that it justified this, but that he was just trying to find love. And in that moment, I felt like I understood him because I know what it's like to feel like I need love and I can't get it. And I feel so hungry and desperate for it. And so as I looked at him, having that realization was mind-altering for me. It was like soul-altering. And I felt like God said to me in that moment, Megan, your sin is not due to you thinking you're better or I've heard this phrase a million times. The root of my sin wasn't pride. It wasn't that I thought I was better. The root of my sin was not understanding how incredibly loved by God I was and how I was just loved and I was loved and I was loved. And when I didn't understand that love, when I tried to get it elsewhere, that's when I started acting poorly. When I demanded love of other people, when I was greedy, when I was trying to collect resources for myself because I thought there wasn't enough. All of these, bad behaviors that I had were all ultimately due to the fact that I believed that I was unlovable. And I was trying to get that love. And so here I saw it in this man and I saw it in me. And it was like, I just wept on the floor. And I was like, I finally understand why I sometimes act the way I do. It's because I don't get that I'm loved. And I just felt God's love just saturate me in that moment. And it really changed everything for me in the way that I functioned in the world. I wasn't functioning as trying to be good and trying to earn love and trying to earn, my way into heaven. It suddenly became, I am loved. I am whole. I don't need to prove it to anyone. And I'm going to function in that wholeness. And because I was able to finally, for the first time in my life, at the age of 25, have compassion for myself, I was finally able to have compassion for other people. I had compassion for John's for the first time in my life. And that was transformative. And it also helped me understand and ask the questions, why might men buy women? I mean, there's a whole range of reasons. And sometimes it's, a lot more violence. I've heard stories from women, but sometimes it's just old guys. They don't even want to have sex. They just want to talk. Right. And then you have other stories where it's just the most extreme violence. But I think both of those is the idea that I'm not enough as a man, that I need a woman's affirmation, or I need to demonstrate my power and my control and my violence to prove my masculinity. And so, that was just a profound life-changing, life-altering realization. And it honestly changed everything for me. And the way I interact in the world is completely different. I'm 32 now. That was 7 years ago, but it still has had the most profound impact on me. It was such a holy moment with God.
Yeah, that's cool. I really appreciated that. I think I've talked about this a lot. Like as a pastor, I stand up there most Sunday mornings and it's like really easy for me to say that God loves you. Right.
Yeah.
But the one thing that's really difficult is to say that God loves me.
Yes.
And I think that realization is what changes everything. Right.
That,
yeah. And it's a journey. I mean, I'm sure after these 7 years, you're still learning what that means to be loved by God. Right. And
And to love myself as well. Yeah. I feel like we really struggle in that area as well. So,
yeah. I appreciated you talking about all of that. Cause I mean, during your time overseas, like you experienced a lot of abuse, not only just like as a viewer, but yourself and just like your surround, like you, you endured a lot, we'll just say. And I think the openness with that is profound and has to be difficult, I guess.
I mean, I think the reason that I wanted to tell my story as a memoir is because I feel like what really changed a lot of things for me was understanding that I wasn't alone and what I had lived through. Some of the things I was sexually assaulted. I've been sexually assaulted. For many years, I felt so much shame. Like that was my fault. I was responsible for that. But the truth is that's not my fault. And that is not my responsibility. And I think through me telling my stories, I know I'm not the only one. I mean, statistically in the United States, 1 in 3 women is the survivor of sexual assault or domestic violence. It's 1 in 3. That's insane. So I know when I'm telling my story, I am not the only one. I'm telling my story because there are other women like me. There are countless women like me. And through telling our stories and knowing that we're not alone, there's such, I think, a solidarity and a hope that comes from that. Because if I'm not alone, then I know that there's some, like, I'm not the problem, and there's something systemic that we can do to fight this. And so for me, understanding that I wasn't alone, and that it wasn't just here in the United States that I was, you know, it was the United States, it was Africa, it was Europe, it was Southeast Asia. Like, this was everywhere, this oppression of women, the sexual assault and objectification of women is everywhere. So the question is, why, and why does it keep happening? And it's not my fault, because for so long, even the way we interact in the world, you know, with purity culture, like, don't show it if it's not on the market. Your body makes men do bad things. I mean, we look at this most recent shooting that, well, it wasn't the most recent one, unfortunately.
Right. Which is,
But in Atlanta, 2 weeks ago, a man shot 8 people to eliminate his sexual temptation. Right. And this man was, he grew up in a Baptist scene. And so for me, like, I immediately connected this whole idea where I was raised being told my body was the problem and my body made men do bad things. And wearing that, and then seeing that that man literally said, I'm eliminating the temptation, and so I killed these women. I think this is directly tied to the teachings that we had in the church. And I think it's time for that to change. It's why I wrote the book.
Yeah. Amen to that. And just your experiences of purity culture and like how that like sort of affected you. There's a lot there, and this is like a really tangled web to unweave as you bring in sort of this complementarian theology along with purity culture, and like you're bringing together a lot of threads that sort of coalesce, and the subjugation of women, honestly. And there's a lot there, I guess, to untangle. So one of the interesting parts towards the end of the book was you talking about how the United States compares to other countries and sort of these markers. And I think most of us would think that, like, we're pretty, there's equality or some equity between men and women. Right. But I mean, statistics show that that's not true. Can you talk just a little bit about some of that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's another thing that is sadly part of our church is this Christian nationalism. America is the best. We save everyone. In fact, that was literally what I was taught. Like, America saves everyone from themselves. And so that obviously breeds elitism, which I also had to unlearn, being a United States citizen, that, maybe we're not the best, and maybe we have things to learn from other countries. But when, you know, my book's about gender equity, it's about women's rights. And so, you know, when you think about gender equity, you're like, oh, you know, the United States is probably not the best, but we're like, we're up there. But the sad truth is we're not up there. According to a 2018, there's a gender parity report that was done over the whole world. The United States, so I actually want to pause for a second. I want the listeners to guess just in their head, where do you think the United States ranks out of, I think it was 180 countries? I'm pretty sure it was 180 countries that they did. So just spend a moment, where does the United States rank from 1 to 180 or somewhere around that? Okay, so I'm guessing, I don't know if that was enough time for you guys.
That was good, yeah.
But I'm guessing you're probably thinking maybe like top 10, top 20. But the United States actually ranks number 51 out of the countries surveyed. And there's a lot of reasons for this. But one of them is that the United States has one of the lowest representations of women in our government. So women are not well representative. And so I talk in my book about other countries I had gone to, but the Philippines is much better in this area. And Uganda, another country I served in, much better in this area, and subsequently rank higher than us due to this. Another thing that the United States is really far behind in is maternal health care and maternity, paid maternity leave. We're the only developed wealthy nation, and only two nations total in the whole world that they do the ranking for that don't have paid maternity or paternity leave by law. That's insane. And so
that is crazy.
It is crazy. So people like want to fight. So I know that abortion is a hot button issue in the United States, but we don't ask again the question, why? why would someone feel like they need to get an abortion? Could it be that when they have a child, they're at risk of losing their job?
Yeah.
They're at risk of not being able to provide for their children because the United States has no safeguards for women giving birth in this country. On top of that, we have one of the, in terms, again, of the wealthier countries of 10 countries surveyed, the United States ranks very near the bottom in terms of maternal health death rates. And then on top of that, Black women or Indigenous women are 2 to 3 times more likely to die in childbirth during as compared to white women. And so there's all of these areas that the United States is actually quite far behind in when we're talking about developed and wealthy nations, but also as the country, like the world as a whole, we're pretty far behind, especially in the area of having women represent our government and maternal health care. And again, let's ask that question, why? Well, a lot, you know, if we look at us, I mean, church attendance is going down. In fact, a Pew Research just came out that for the first time in like since the study's been taken, church attendance has fallen down, our membership has fallen below 50%. But if we look at historically at our nation, you know, we're a predominantly Christian nation, but a lot of these predominantly Christian spaces also believe that women couldn't lead or teach or preach. And so people think, oh, well, I'm just talking about, some people might say, well, I'm just talking about like church. Well, unfortunately, that bleeds outside of church. And there are prominent theologians, for example, John Piper, who doesn't believe that women should even be in the police force or in government because we women aren't supposed to lead men. And so it has been shown again and again and again that the more women you have in leadership positions, the more just and equitable a society becomes. And on top of that, if we're talking about maternal healthcare, there's a reason that women's healthcare is falling behind in this nation. It's because, again, that women for so long, it's been a struggle for them to get into that profession. And as a result, women's voices aren't heard. They're not valued. I have stories again and again and again of women going to their doctors and not being believed about their ailments or being told it's hysteria. So even our medical industry or health professionals don't believe women. And so this is all tied, I think, to the idea that women aren't as capable to lead or teach or preach or, you know, to even be co-heirs with men because we have been raised with the belief that women are less than and have to be submissive. And so I have run into this problem so many times. A lot of churches won't take me seriously as a woman because it's literally their theology that they cannot learn from a woman. I've had conversations with men who are arguing with me and I say, why am I having this discussion with you? Because according to your theology, I cannot teach you. Like this is literally your theology. So of course you're not going to listen to me. Right. You think it's sinful to listen to me. And so when we're talking about the United States, we have to understand that we're actually pretty far behind when it comes to women's equity and that we have a lot of work to do. We're not the best at everything as we've been told.
Yeah. All of that's staggering. Just the way we care for women, especially mm-hmm. the maternity and paternity. My wife, when she was having our first child, like FMLA mm-hmm. only applies to like actually keeping your job. They don't have to like right. give you any money or anything. Right. And my wife was like a month short of even applying for FMLA. Mm-hmm. So like lost her job because we were having a baby.
Yeah.
You know, like I, what?
It's wrong. It's right? so it wrong. Yeah. And it shows that we don't value women in the workforce. So it's women are less likely to be hired because they could get pregnant. But if we had a society that valued women and understood like, hey, actually having children is good for a nation, like maybe we right. should empower women. And on top of that, this whole idea that there's not even like a, you know, heaven forbid, a paternity, a man's like leave, which is also, I think, necessary. That's something that holds women back because women are viewed as the primary caretakers. They can't be equal. They can't be equal in careers until men are equal in the home. And paternity leave is much rarer than maternity leave, but like it should be when a family has a baby, whether or not you're a man or a woman, you should have time off because that baby is your responsibility. Even if you're a man, like right. you should be responsible and help your wife as she has given birth to a, you know, and raging with hormones and breastfeeding. All like I have friends who, I haven't had children yet, but I have, you know, some of my closest friends are telling me just like, the first like 6 to like 12 weeks after you have a baby, like you're up all night, you're breastfeeding, you're hormonal, you're going crazy, the baby's crying, you can't get the baby to stop crying, you don't have time to even take a shower. Like, I think we should value women in that space, but I also think men should be part of the equation. They were responsible for creating the child. They should be responsible for raising the child. And so I think that's another thing that even needs to switch, is this idea that men don't need to help with their children. Of course they do. But the way our government treats it is like, we don't even give women paid time off for having babies. And it's much, much rarer to even hear of a company ever giving paternity leave, which I think is also something that needs to change.
Yeah. Yeah. So we don't value women and we don't value children.
No.
And so, feels like Christians should be on the leading edge of, of that, but
interesting.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. I mean, part of your story too was just your own love story.
Yeah,
you know, and there's the dude, you know, the other dude, you know, that like, you know.
Yeah, the other guy who like wanted me to be quiet and submissive and. And realizing that's not what God wanted for me. And then also just kind of very skeezy guy. If you read the book, you can read more about it, but just, you know, wasn't honest, wasn't trustworthy. And, you know, when I met my husband, people ask me all the time, like, how did you find him? Like this, like, I didn't know men like him existed. And it's funny because I met him at a wedding. And because I had been rejected, or men lost interest when they found out that I was a feminist or outspoken, because apparently you're not supposed to be that as a Christian woman. So I had guys directly tell me, you know, they would ask for my number and we'd start talking and they'd find that out. I'm like, oh, I don't think you're the kind of Christian woman I want. But so anyways, I met my husband at a wedding, and you know, we both found out we were believers, and I'm like, okay, well, you know, I don't want to waste my time here. So I gave him this like long feminist speech, like the first time I met him. And I was like, let's just like cut to the chase, because if you're not interested, like tell me now, because I don't want to waste my time. And he was very interested and had said to me that he had never met someone so passionate about something ever before. And so that's what drew him to me. So if there's any women listening wondering, where are these good men that, you know, believe in equality between men and women and empower women in their lives, I'd say cut to the chase. tell them where you stand, because part of my story is denying who I was to be accepted by men or to be viewed as attractive or desirable by men, and just having that blow up in my face so profoundly. It's much better to be authentic and honest from the get-go. And so that would be my advice to anyone that is looking for a partner, whether you're a man or a woman.
Yeah, I think so too. I think you said something profound in the book that like, he should make you feel like more of yourself, like a spouse. And that's what we've always counseled other people to do. Like, you should be more of who you are when you're around them, not less.
Yes.
And I think that is a big part of all of this. They should make you better.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
More of who you are.
Yeah. Guess, more of who you are. Say. And also better, because when you're not denying yourself, you're not miserable and you're a kinder and nicer person. And so when I started dating my now husband, my best friend told me, she's like, you treat people after you know, you're kinder to people, you know, you're more loving, you're more like, you're already great, but you're more great after you spend time with him. And he just allows me to be myself, and he's not afraid of, you know, my outspokenness. And he's been such an, like, I cannot even say how grateful I've been for him throughout this whole process, because as one can imagine, speaking about feminism in the church, it has pushed me to the margins. It has made me lose friends. I've gotten hate mail. But he has been the most fierce partner, who reads my hate mail, who supports me, and I would not be doing this work without him. And so I want that for everyone. I don't think you should become less of who you are to be accepted by a man. I think whoever, or a woman, whoever you are, man or woman, I feel like your partner should not be ashamed of you and the things that matter to you. They should empower you to be the best you can, to be more of who you are, which you already said. So
amen. Yeah, amen. Preach it. I love it. Good. Okay. So Megan, where are the best places for everybody to sort of follow you and find you and all the things?
Yeah. So you can follow me on Instagram, Megan Chance. My name is hard to spell, but I'm sure that he'll have my name somewhere in the
notes. It'll be in the show notes.
Yes.
For sure.
But yeah, anywhere you type in that name, you'll find me. I'm the only one that exists. So you'll find me, but my book comes out May 11th. And so I would love, if it's not out yet, if you pre-order it, there's a link in my bio to do that. And if it is out, buy it and read it. It would mean the world to me. As any author will tell you, writing a book is the most vulnerable, terrifying, excavating thing you'll probably ever do. It's, and I mean, Curry's already told you that, man, I'm very vulnerable. I say so many things. And so it's scary. And so I want the world to appreciate it and enjoy it. And I know I'm already going to get some nasty reviews from it. So yeah, if you could buy it and if you like it, write a good review, that would mean the world to me.
Yeah. Good reviews all around.
Yeah.
I love it. I think that's good.
Yeah.
I think that's good. Okay. So are you ready to jump into our final two questions?
Yeah.
Okay. So my first question is, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
Yeah, this was such an interesting, you sent these to me beforehand and I thought about it and I'm like, you know, there's like, I've had a lot of weird jobs. Maybe one of my weirdest jobs was being a nanny in college for the family who like were home the whole time. So like, it was like, I was nannying their children while they were like watching me. And that was really uncomfortable because I felt like I was never trusted or like believed in. But maybe that, or maybe just being a podcaster trying to reclaim feminism for the Christian faith. That seems pretty odd. So probably one of those things.
My wife had a similar nannying job in college.
Yeah.
A little strange. Yeah.
Yeah. But it was very strange. And the family was also very strange, like very strange. So I don't miss that.
Okay, so my final question then is, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring God's kingdom more into their work?
Yeah, I think that's such a good question, because sometimes I think we have a tendency to compartmentalize our lives. And I don't think we should. And so for me, the question of like, how do I bring God, like more of like God's kingdom into my work? Well, I'd first ask yourself, what makes you come alive? What's something that gets you passionate? What's something that, like, if someone asked you a question about it, you would talk for hours and keep talking because it's something you care about? Ask yourself that question and then find a way to either do that as a vocation, but if you can't do it as a vocation, to like bring like those conversations into your work. Like, I know everyone has different jobs and what that looks like, but maybe you work at Starbucks and you talk to your, you know, coworkers about it. Or you use that funds that you earn from your job to like donate towards that cause. I think there's a lot of ways you can do it. For my husband, he's a computer programmer and he is always asking this question, like, how can I like live out what my purpose in my job? And for him, it looks like, well, actually doing a job that values him, and because he used to be a chemical engineer and he hated it. And so part of doing that was doing a job that he felt comfortable in and felt valued in. And then for him and I, like, he supports me, like he makes most of the money to support my vocation. And that's what he feels like he's supposed to do. And so just like asking yourself, what are those questions and what do you care about and how do you do that? And then also, he's also passionate about social justice. And so we have goals to like attend marches quite often throughout the year. So the most recent one we did was against Asian American and Pacific Islander hate. And so we were just there past Sunday joining in a demonstration for that. So like, show up, find a way to show up for the communities you care about.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's great advice. And Megan, thanks so much for making time for me. It was super fun to chat.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing from Megan and just walking through a little of her life. I highly recommend reading her book, Women Rising. It's from IVP. They always do a great job with these books. And her book is just, it's powerful. You will experience all of the emotions. And I think what she's talking about is really important stuff. Her experiences are important. We need to be talking about this as a church. And
This is a great place to start for you. It's a really great read, easy read, and you'll get a lot out of it. So I highly recommend that. I just want to remind you that right now is a great time to go to the bottom of your iTunes app. You can leave a rating and review there, which just helps me get the word out about the podcast, lets other people know people are listening, and I just love hearing what you're getting out of it. So leave a rating and review, and until next time, get out there and hustle.